do you have the right response when it's needed? Most people have no control over that dial. Like, right? They've never done anything that's hard enough to know what hard actually is, but they've never downregulated enough to know what that's like on the other end of the spectrum. So they're crushed from both ends of the spectrum, and they live in this kind of no man's kind of dead zone area.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Morning Coffee. My name is Rick Alexander. You guys can follow me at RickAlexander_ on Instagram. And of course, if you're getting anything from the show, it would mean the world to me if you would share it with your friends, your following, head to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Mike T. Nelson. If you guys are familiar with my work or have been following us for a little while or are familiar with the Special Forces experience, you know that I interviewed Mike on the science of becoming a more robust human and kind of talked all through the gamut. We talked about fasting, we talked about cold and breath work, all kinds of different things. And so today, as I'm having him back on the show to talk further about some of these ideas, I also am realizing how deep we are into this quarantine now. And so I'd love to like talk about some of the ways that we can leverage some of these things to help people reverse some probably bad behavior or negative behavior that they've built up or negative habits they've built up over the quarantine process. But all of that to say, Mike, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back again. I must have enjoyed the first one, so I'm back. So that's good.
Right. That's always good.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you know, these like technically difficult conversations or technically complex conversations they're always difficult. I mean, they're difficult for me just because I'm dealing with a average aptitude here, but I love to try to take some of these concepts that people like you are exploring and just make them more feasible for people to kind of get their hands on and understand.
Totally. I agree. Yeah. Cause it's as much as I love research and trying crazy shit in my garage, at the end of the day, it has to be practical for someone because they need to go out and do the action. And if they are completely lost and don't even know where to start, probably not being so useful.
Right. Right. Totally. Yeah. And yeah. Okay. So we'll start actually there. So right now we're pretty deep into this quarantine, like I'd mentioned. And I think based on a lot of the practices that you utilize just within yourself, within the athletes that you train, with some of the teachings that you certify people in, and of course, we'll talk about all of that. You know, it's kind of one of the things I'm thinking about is this idea that like sometimes when your life is a mess, the first thing you do is you start cleaning, like you clean your room, you just start organizing things so you can like take control of stuff. So what are some low hanging fruit for people that have totally fallen off any kind of movement practice and schedule? Like where can we start dealing with this, and we'll kind of go up the scale to the athletic folks at the end?
Yeah, I'm a big thing when I did all my clients and teachers, just what is your morning routine? And I know I get a lot of pushback from people that are like, I have 3 kids and getting up is just a routine. And it's like, no, I totally get it. I don't have any kids, but I work with clients who, you know, have, you know, 3 to 5 kids, so I get it. But I think starting in the morning is just easier from a scheduling standpoint. Nothing technically has happened yet. So I tell people just be intentional about what are the things you're going to do in the morning. All right, that may be as simple as getting up by not hitting snooze 4 times on your alarm and then making coffee, right? Great. Awesome. But I would encourage you probably then to buy some better coffee. If you want to try it in a French press or pour over something, probably do something in that area. Like start wherever you can and then expand out a little bit from there. Ideas wise, obviously I like people to take a morning walk, I think is a good idea. Just get some movement, kind of get out of your head. You know, sometimes if you have kids, maybe if your other parent is home, you can sneak out a little bit before they get up. If you can see the sunlight just coming up then, much better for regulation of circadian rhythm, a bunch of other benefits. But I think just being intentional about what you're going to do first thing in the morning, I think that's a really good place to start. And then, you know, worst case scenario, hey, you got a couple things done off your list. You got a morning walk, you got some movement in, maybe get crazy, do a little meditation along the way or some breath work. And at least if everything else just goes to heck in a henbasket, then, you know, you still got, you know, some things done, right? Because I think it's human nature to want to think, oh, I'm going to get up and I'm going to do this crazy like 4-hour routine I saw on biohackers.com and all this crazy stuff. And you get like to step two and you're like, okay, I guess I'm not going to make it. Right? Ah, screw it. I didn't need to do any of that stuff anyway. Right. So just pick something simple and then kind of expand out from there. And if you're just consistent with those things, you know, most days of the week, that little small consistent work is going to add up over time.
Yeah, totally. You know, in Buddhist philosophy, something I've been getting into lately, they have this idea of like all of life is samsara, death and rebirth. And so they try to approach every night as if it were sort of a death. And in the point of that is that you actually let go all of the things that you didn't get to. And I love the idea of starting in the morning, like you're saying, because it does feel a bit fresh. It's like, no matter what, how bad you fell off yesterday, it's like, well, now we have like a fresh chance to sort of put ourselves on the right track and use that momentum in the right way for us.
Yeah. I think everyone's had that experience. I mean, I've had it, you know, probably a little bit more than usual where, you know, you try your best intentions. Oh, I get through most of the morning routine. Everything is good. And then like everything just goes to heck.
Totally.
And I've had more than a few nights where I'm just like, this day just kind of sucked. And I'm just going to bed early and I'm starting over tomorrow. I'm not going to try to get anything more else done. It is what it is. And, you know, tomorrow is another day and maybe I just need to go to bed 2 hours early and start over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We always want to like feel like we have to undo stuff that we did wrong or fix things. It's like, actually, maybe you just need to go to bed and try it again tomorrow. And, you know, since our first conversation, I've started, just because it was like top of mind, I started doing, which is very easy, a fasted walk every morning. Like I'll just do black coffee and I'll do between 3 and 6 miles every morning, just walking fasted.
That's awesome.
And one of the things I'm noticing about it, and I don't know if you can talk to this at all, but I feel that cognition seems to be enhanced. I feel clearer. Is there any physiological evidence of that or that you know of?
Yeah, there's some. So how I got a little bit into walking was when I was doing my PhD, I was at home. I worked from home. I was training people. I moved most of my training business online. And so literally I was in my house, like trying to get stuff done from the time I got up. This is when I was writing my dissertation. So I had done all the lab stuff and I had just got a watch that was measuring step count. So before I had used pedometers and all this, you know, old school like technology, I bought myself a new watch. I'm like, oh, this is great. It's going to measure sleep, a bunch of stuff. And I put a little piece of paper and tape over it. So I didn't look at it for 3 days, just out of curiosity to see like how many steps I get. And it was between 530 to like 850, like horrible, like just beyond bad. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's like really low. I wonder what happens if I just move a little more. And as I started moving more, then I got into rowing, did some more aerobic stuff in the morning. And the same thing I realized as you, and like I've had a lot of clients realize the same thing is, oh, wow, like, my brain works so much better. Like I don't need 7 cups of coffee to get through the day. And I think part of that, maybe just movement, right? Taking in some information and having your body coordinate something that is can be a conscious thing, but is also autonomous at the same time. Right? Kind of like breathing and blinking, things we can have a little bit of control over, but you don't have to be like, okay, right foot, left foot. Okay, move your arm this way. It's okay, I want to go there. And you can kind of zone out a little bit from the walking and eye movements, paying attention, different stimulus. There's some pretty good data looking at aerobic exercise for brain function. Mm. John Ratley wrote a really good book called Spark. It's a little bit,
incredible
older book now, but really, really good. We know that helps enhance hippocampal volume and a bunch of other benefits. And you know, pretty much everyone I've had do more aerobic exercise, not that they all need to be endurance athletes or anything like that. If you want to be like you and run crazy 100-mile races, that's totally cool. But I just find that the lower to moderate-ish intensity stuff seems to have a really big benefit for aerobic metabolism and just overall energy levels and just cognition in general.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely, I found a law of diminishing returns somewhere around like intensity, you know, but
yes.
Walking is, I guess, and I didn't even really think about, I'm familiar with some of that research, especially as far as like releasing was a BDNF, brain-derived
neurotrophic factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm familiar with some of that. I guess I didn't think about that as far as walking, but I'm so taken aback by how much vitality I feel, how healthy I feel from literally doing nothing but walking.
Yeah, and it's not hard, right? People, I think we always associate movement and especially exercise as something that has to be this heroic thing. And the longer I've been doing exercise, the more I'm like, yeah, there's definitely times and places to do that. If you have a big race, yes, you need to put out some intensity at some point if you want to get better, absolutely. But I think there's a lot we can gain from low to moderate-ish intensity, done with intention, just day in and day out, especially in today's modern society, especially now where, a lot of people are just not moving as much. I mean, I know I have to schedule myself. It sounds weird. Like to take 2 walks just to hit 8,000 steps a day consistently because I'm in my house the whole time.
right, totally. Yeah, same thing. I'll do a morning and a night walk just so I can get a decent amount of steps. And something that stuck with me, I remember I had Dr. Andy Galpin on the show a while ago. And
yeah.
And when he was releasing that book with Brian McKenzie.
Unplugged,
yep. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about, he's like, that 10,000 steps is great, but we're kind of identifying that as the bare minimum to not die super quick.
Yeah.
It's like, damn, okay. So I think what people are finding out right now is something that probably, entrepreneurs, I'm sure that you found out a long time ago, which is like, one of the great things about not having a boss is you can do whatever you want. And one of the worst things about not having a boss is that you can do whatever you want. And so you really have to like learn to become your own manager in that way, just as you do when you're becoming an adult, right? It's like you have to realize you can't eat the raw brownie batter every day. So as far as this quarantine for you, is there anything that you found that's helped you stay productive and stay in a good headspace, I guess, outside of just working out or outside of training for physical adaptation?
Yeah, so I was in kind of Costa Rica when it came down and came back and was just like, holy crap, this is crazy. This is like way different. So I had my 2 or 3 days of watching the news, trying to figure out what was going on, freaking out, wondering what I'm going to do with my business. Like most of my online clients, probably 60-70% of them are trainers themselves. So then I start catastrophizing, thinking, oh my God, they're all going to drop off now.
Right.
Never mind that. Probably a good population to work with because they prioritize training, but a lot of them work in gyms, the gyms are closed, all that kind of stuff. And once I kind of got through all of that and figured out what I was going to do, I was like, okay, so for the next foreseeable future, so my whole travel schedule from April, May, and June, we're supposed to be gone almost all of April, half of May, half of June, all that just got like wiped out. So I'm like, okay, so I'm at home and that's about it. So I'm like, well, maybe this is the perfect time then to do an aerobic base block in the morning. So I got my trainer for my bike out, set that up in the garage. I've got a rower in the garage. I figured, well, that way, even if, because at this time I didn't know, I'm like, maybe they're not going to let us out of our house. Maybe I can't ride outside. What if it rains? I'm like, I'll just set the trainer up. I'll put it in the garage. I won't have any excuses. So I'm like, okay, so I'm going to get up, do that each morning. And I just set up just more of a, I guess, robust morning routine and just tried to follow that every day. I had bought a freezer, luckily, beforehand. So finally got that sealed and water tested. So filled that full of cold water, got that running so I could do some cold water immersion in the morning also.
You doing that every day?
So, yeah, I've done that every day now for 24 days in a row. So, yeah, I got the one that's big enough where I'm 6'3". So I can fit all the way in it with the water up to my chin and still stay submerged. I can't quite figure out a way to get my head in it at the end other than getting out and kind of do the inversion thing where I look like a bird dunking my head in the thing.
Yeah.
But so that's been good. And I just figured, okay, now is the time just to work on a routine. I don't have any excuse. Like there's no one preventing me. I'm not going anywhere. I don't have any travel. And just double down on that, and then the tasks that I needed to get done each morning. I decided to sleep as much as I could, so I took 3 weeks and just kept going to bed earlier and just allowed myself to sleep in until I woke up. At that point, I was sleeping 9 hours and 47 minutes a night on average.
Incredible.
For a while. Uh-huh. And I'm like, well, you know, this is probably a good time to work more on, you know, body composition, right? I'm controlling all the food I bring in my house. I have the ability to sleep. My stressors are a little bit less. So did that. So, you know, since my peak was December, was at 226. This morning I was at 214. And strength hasn't really gone down that much other than lower body stuff, just from more aerobic training, which will happen just acutely. I'm not too worried about it. And then, yeah, just trying to control that as much as possible. Get a little bit more tighter with inputs, try and not allow myself email first thing in the morning. I would only listen to maybe two news sources, which were just podcasts. And I have email set up where I've got other systems that'll go in and pull it off of Yahoo and Gmail and business accounts so that I don't even have to go to the login page on Yahoo and see any of the headlines, like nothing at all. I realized the news was like kind of screwing me up, even though I don't watch a lot of news. But even just news items on, you know, Facebook and social media and other places like that. So I just kind of cut all that out even more than what I had in the past and just said, okay, here's the tasks I need to get done. Here's my priority list. And I just started going from there.
So I'm curious about that. And that was actually going to be my next question anyway, which is how have you noticed sort of being so tuned into your physiology and you know what you're up to, how you're adapting to your environment? What did you notice about, or what have you noticed about sort of the news? Was it like the fear? Was it dampening motivation? Like, how was it kind of affecting you? I think that's part of, I think right now a lot of people are sort of auto-consuming. They don't know what's going on with them. It's sort of like hitting them from the angles they don't see. I don't know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I'm generally pretty good with it. Like the only news I would see is when I would travel, right? I don't know how the airports got the CNN contract, but it seems to be at like DEFCON levels every time you go through the airport and stuff. And then I rely on if anything major happens, my mom will call me or friends will call me, you know, if something really weird happens.
Yeah.
And then they usually have the running bet on if I knew about it or not, which normally I don't. But I did, you know, for a while, cause I'm like, oh, what's going on with this? I need to be an informed consumer. And then my kind of cutoff point was one when I realized my HRV was getting worse, right? So my stress levels were worse. Digestion was a little worse. I felt a little bit more edgy. And then when I realized there wasn't any for a while, and even kind of now, there wasn't really any new data coming out. So it's like, okay, so what am I looking for, right? There wasn't a whole lot of data. There wasn't a lot of testing, you know? And so I'm like, there isn't anything new. It's just being rehashed of stuff before. Generally very fear-based. I don't think you need to be an ostrich and stick your head in the sand and pretend like nothing's going on. But, you know, once we sat down with my wife and are like, okay, so kind of what is our sort of home protocol? Like, how do we get stuff delivered? What do we do if we have to go out? What do we do with, you know, stuff with the mail, things like that? Once we got that kind of figured out, I'm like, well, I don't know how watching the news is going to change anything that I'm really doing right now.
Right.
If it's not going to change any of it, then do I really need to be consuming it? So I'm like, yeah, probably not. Right. So every once in a while, I listen to a podcast about it. But even then, I have my little criteria of only who I would listen to. Right. It can be just some random person. It had to be, you know, Osterholm or someone that had a reputation of being a knowledgeable expert in the area. And then ideally, could that be an interview with them particular, not someone else interpreting the interview? So trying to get to whatever was the primary source, if at all possible.
Yeah. So now that you've done that, how are you feeling about all of this? Just, I guess asking as an educated person that's taken the time to vet what they've listened to.
Yeah. It's just weird, man. It's like, I mean, like going through the airports, coming back. I mean, even now, like I have a little porch here in a townhouse. So I'll, you know, sit outside and meditate in the morning and it's just so quiet. Like, I ever remember a time in my life living here. I've lived in the same place for 13 years where it's been that quiet at even like 11 in the morning, you know, even odd times, like and just walking around, like just not seeing a lot of people around. And even just, I also realized this the other day, I was telling my wife that I'm like, the other part that I miss is like, I can't pet dogs. Because normally I would see a dog and I'd ask the owner, hey, is it all right if I pet the puppy? But you can't really get close to other humans there. And So now it's funny to watch dogs walk by and they see them, they kind of look at you and they're like, why don't ever the humans ever pet me anymore? They just look so confused.
Yeah.
So different stuff like that. And I think now Minnesota will open back up supposedly the 3rd. I don't know what the ramifications are of that. It's just it's an odd thing where consciously or subconsciously you're looking at other people as someone that could be a risk, right? So whether you wear a mask or not, that's a whole different debate. But the main reason of wearing a mask that's not, you know, one like a hospital grade mask is so that if you happen to have it, you're not, you know, giving it to somebody else. But then there's this weird thing where, like, there's not many people around here, so I'll walk around outside without a mask on because I'm not really close to anyone anyway. But every once in a while, you get funny looks from people wearing masks that kind of, and this could be just entirely my own self-perception of, why aren't you wearing one? Don't you care about your other humans? This kind of weird, funny look to it, I guess. So,
yeah,
I don't know, that's what I find is kind of odd. And then, yeah, I don't know. You wonder if like interactions will ever go back to the way that they were. And even if they were, like, what is the criteria to use for that? Do we all need some little bracelet that says I've had an antibody test? And then when was it done? How often do you do it? You know, so it's the reintegration part, I think, will be interesting, right? Because we even had a debate with my wife the other night of like, well, when do we travel again? You know, if we're going to visit someone who's, it's not a high risk place, it's not very population dense, when do you, if the states are open, do you go right away? Do you wait to see if there's a second wave, see what happens? Yeah.
Yeah. I've been,
any thoughts you have?
Yeah. No, I similar thoughts, really. I've been trying to put piece apart the subconscious psychological effects. Like, what are we not knowing about ourselves and how are we being affected in ways that we're not aware of? And I remember going into Target and seeing these grown men fight back and forth about being too close to each other. And and it's very interesting, you know, I was like, one thing is really, oh, we're being conditioned right now to see other people as a problem.
Yeah.
So we're like getting very avoidant and stuff. And
yeah.
It's very interesting to me to think about how that plays out in any kind of long-term scenario.
Yeah. And I mean, my personal opinion is I don't think anything's going to go back to normal. It's just going to be different.
Totally.
You know, what that looks like. I don't have any idea. And even once this one passes, because it's happened, everyone will think that, oh, this could happen again. Mm-hmm. Right. So before it happened, and myself included, it's like, oh, I don't know, that odds of that, all these people talking about it, that's crazy. And then when something like that does happen, you're like, well, I can't just say that it will never happen again. Right. So you're kind of stuck with that subconscious programming, for better or worse.
Right. Yeah. The illusion of safety is for sure gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I think too, a lot of like the stuff that definitely that we had talked about in the last episode is right now, if you're not someone that's prioritized things like breath work and cardiovascular work, and like you're in a tougher spot even.
Yes.
It seems to be. I can't say that definitively, but it does seem to be. As far as that goes, is there anything that you offer or anything that you have seen as far as breath work being beneficial in today's environment?
Maybe. I mean,
that's how I feel. I've been trying to watch experts, and it seems like I see Brian McKenzie talking about the benefit of CO2 intolerance and stuff. And I've been trying to piece apart whether there's some, what the benefits there are for people.
Yeah, I love Brian's stuff and him and Rob. I took their Art of Breath course, which is awesome. Love their stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, I've been playing around more with the CO2 tolerance stuff again. I've used the Bolt test, which is Patrick McEwen's stuff. I even have a friggin' metabolic cart with a CO2 analyzer in it. So I've been doing some experiments with that. So I think there is a correlation between CO2 and aerobic fitness. I don't know exactly what the correlation is. I think you may still be able to get to a higher level of aerobic fitness and still be somewhat CO2 intolerant. So I don't know exactly where they kind of all mesh together. I think for most people, some type of breath work that allows them to just downregulate, right? So I see that most people have very hard time with downregulation. know, they just are, it's just really, really hard for them to do. So I usually will start them off with kind of some Wim Hof stuff for maybe three rounds. And then that time when they're doing an exhale, whether you do it as a hard exhale or not, just pay attention to that kind of nice quiet space. Then at the end, just try to breathe really shallow and just try to be as quiet as possible. And so for a lot of people, that's the first time in their life they've ever felt really quiet. So I think that's useful. And then, you know, once stuff opens up again, I do a lot of hands-on work with RPR, be activated training to get everything around the rib cage, you know, moving. And mechanically, that makes a huge difference too. Because a lot of people are just, as you know, so stuck that their thoracic isn't moving at all. So that makes it very hard for them to do some breath work. I think there's still benefits to breath work, but in a perfect world, if you can fix your mechanics first and then have you do some better breath work, is going to be easier.
Yeah, totally. When you were talking earlier about morning routine, is that the 33 rounds of Wim Hof, is there anything that you suggest that you have liked in your morning routine for people to start?
Yeah, so what I did for a long time, which I got from Mike Bledsoe when we were in Mexico probably 4 or 5 years ago, he took us through a whole Wim Hof routine on the beach in the morning, which was super beneficial. So I went home and kind of went a little bit apeshit on that for a while. And it was really good. But at the end of the day, I think it's still very sympathetic driven because of the amount of hyperventilation you're doing.
Because of the force, yeah.
Yeah. So I changed it to a nasal inhale and just let go. So I'll try to get more nasal breathing. I think that's a good intro. Lately, I've been doing more of just old school style. I call it the Zen style of stare at a tree. Mm-hmm. So just sit there, don't move. I got this from Dr. Ben House's dad. And just try that, which for me is really hard because I realized that I was probably using a lot of breath techniques and counting and this program and that program. And I think it was really good to experiment and have different experiences. But I think at some level, I was almost using that as a crutch to still not just sit there and be with my own thoughts and just let them go.
Yeah.
So I found it doesn't feel as beneficial, but I could notice when I wasn't doing it, even days that it was very hard. Right. And the whole point is there is no judgment. Just do the practice. Right. I mean, the instructions for it are just like so simple, you know, because people, when we're down in Costa Rica and he's taking us through this, we've been down there many times and we're like, okay, so what do we do? He's like, okay, just find a spot, you know, a couple inches in front of you and just focus. Okay. And then just breathe. Well, what do we think about? Just let your thoughts go. We don't really think about anything. What if we count? No, just let your thoughts, you know, there's like nothing else to it, but it takes like a lifetime of practicing to try to get better at it too.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that exact same realization with my meditation, which is, okay, I actually think I'm just distracting myself in a way that I'm calling meditation. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Let me ask you this. Do you meditate for the physiological benefits, for the spiritual benefits, for what do you get out of meditation?
I would say all the above. I mean, if I went back, like I was thinking about this, a while ago, I'm like, when was the first time I ever did any breath work or meditation? I was like, oh, it was Andrew Weil's book. Like, God, I can't remember. Like Healthy. I don't remember the name of it, but it was in like 1996, right? It was one of the first health books he had, and he'd had a breathing practice in there. So I remember started doing that. And so since then I've kind of played with stuff, not played with stuff, did it, not did it. And up until probably 4 or 5 years ago, I worked with Mike Bledsoe. I kept trying to do stuff and I kept getting it smaller and smaller and smaller. So eventually I'm like, I'll just do 30 seconds every morning. And it got to the point where it's like, I don't feel any different at all. So it's all worthless. So I think the Wim Hof stuff was good to be like, oh, wow, here's this place you can get to without moving, just doing breath work. Wow, that's kind of crazy. Oh, wow, you can get there. It's like the picture of the destination of where you want to go. And I think from that point on, has been more of a journey to try to get to the similar place with as little as possible, right? So I kind of think of like training. It's like, okay, you can do a heavy squat, but you need like a set of briefs and you need this and this and a belt and all this other stuff. Like maybe a progression is to lift the same weight, but just do it raw, right? And I don't care if you lift equipped or not equipped, doesn't matter. For me, it was like, can I try to strip everything else away from it and try to get to that same point? Because I realized, like, throughout the course of my life, I was super impatient, like incredibly CO2 intolerant, if you want to use that, breathe through my mouth, like super, super stressed, darty eyeballs, eye issues, like the whole nine yards of just being massively sympathetic, like,
yeah, just
all
living
the time.
In that fight or flight.
Yeah. And you can get a lot of shit done doing that, but there's a really high, you know, cost associated with it. So after my PhD, I was just literally like burnt toast for probably 2.5 years. Like, yeah. I had just kind of gone over the top. And I remember the last 4 months finishing going, okay, I just want to finish and not do any permanent damage to myself. You know, when you're taking caffeine power naps twice a day to sleep in 6 hours a night. And so I got through and I'm like, it'll be fine. I'll just sleep a lot and I'll fix all my issues. And, you know, long story short, I had to go to, you know, physician and get some stuff figured out, with my gut. And it was at that point where I'm like, yeah, I should probably take this meditation stuff a little bit more serious as a way to downregulate myself without having to exercise myself into oblivion also. Can I get to a more similar state and just sit and be okay with all the thoughts that are running around in my head instead of feeling like I really need to distract myself from them all the time? And then consequently, I'll block out a period of time where I may have a notebook, I may not. And I'm like, okay, I got 15 minutes. I'm just going to sit here and I'm just going to write whatever shows up, right? So actually giving myself permission and time to actually think and to work through stuff. So like when I did the Flex Diet Cert, I would come up with a framework and then I would lock myself for 90 minutes in like a float chamber and then think about that thing, trying to disprove the model that I created. And then I would come out and just write everything down for like 45 minutes. So trying to give myself a block of time where I'm trying to get all the other inputs as low as possible to think about something and just to see what actually shows up at that point.
Do you have a lot of insight in that practice? That sounds cool.
Yeah, I did. I think it was good. And the only downside I've noticed about it though is my initial assumption was the ideas that I have there and what comes out of it must be really amazing. And the first couple ideas I had were a disaster.
Okay.
So again, like anything, right? Whenever you have an idea, you kind of think, oh, this is the best thing ever. This is going to work. And I designed this new product that I thought was going to be amazing. And I had done everything, launched it to my list and spent probably 6 months promoting it to my list. And I sold like 3 copies of it. It was a freaking absolute disaster by all stretches of the imagination.
Yes.
So not all the thoughts you have are going to be the best ones ever, but I found if I just write them down and then I'll go back and review it. And then now what I'll set up is a system of how do I test that? Mm-hmm. Right. So I came out of that and said, well, talk to some other people, talk to Ryan Lee. It's like, well, maybe you should do a certification and not just a continuing education product. I'm like, oh man, I don't want to be one of those, you know, guys that's selling their own certification that just some dude created. But I also realized that, you know, that's kind of what trainers want. And the reality is they want a system that's going to solve their problem more so than they want continuing ed, right? There's always a subset that want continuing ed, but most people want a system that's going to solve the problem that they have. And once I figured that out, I was like, oh, okay. That makes a little bit more sense. So how can I test that in the easiest way? So I gave myself 4 months to come up with the framework, locked myself in float chambers, trying to disprove it. And then I said, okay, here's the framework. Here's what it's about. I sent some stuff to my list and I said, we're going to start it 2 weeks from now. And then I'm going to put out a new module every week for, you know, basically the next 9 weeks in a row. And actually went pretty good. I think if 4 people bought it at that point, I probably would have shit canned all of it. I probably would have showed up somewhere else, but at least I got a little bit wiser and said, okay, I'm going to test what people think of this idea. And I'm going to base that on, are they going to pay me money for this thing or not? If they are, great. Here's the timeline. Here's the schedule. I'll deliver it as promised. But if 4 people buy it, I'm like, yeah, here's your money back. Sorry. I'm going to move on to something else. So,
Yeah. Okay. So there's some incredible nuggets in there for people that I want to
know.
Well, no, I think that there was like three things I think that people could. So first of all, it's just blocking off time to think in any capacity, yeah. right? Because
yeah.
what you find is like to improve thinking, it really becomes about discernment in what thoughts are worth validating and what are worth letting go. And before you block off time to do that, or before you get any kind of meditative practice, you just are your thoughts. And so you're just this constant stream of garbage. And so you've got to learn to like what to let go. And when I was getting out of the military, I remember, you know, after 12 years in a special forces capacity, I was with the doc and we were talking about different, he's like kind of giving me the rundown on like, well, I wouldn't think about claiming this, what injuries to talk about, which ones not to. And I was just, I remember thinking like, man, I feel like I've had the gas and the brakes on physiologically for 12 years. Like I just like, that's what it, I think that like sympathetic state does to us. And a lot of people have learned to perform in that place. And it just feels like it's using resources at a really quick rate.
Yep.
And so I think blocking off that time when I first got out of the military, which is funny because I think I first started doing that because Mike Bledsoe told me to.
Nice. We blame Bledsoe for a lot of stuff.
Well, he's always trying something new. Like, so he'll always find something that works.
And then
I think creating that space in my day, though, what allowed me to like start to downregulate, even if I wasn't doing anything. I was just like going, I'd sit on the beach and just think. You know, figure out what was worth validating and what wasn't. So out of that came your flexible nutrition cert, flexible diet cert.
So out of that was the flex diet cert, which shout out to Ryan Lee. It was actually his idea. I went to a 2-day mastermind with him and I was just telling him like, hey, I just did this whole product. It was just a disaster. It was a shit show. I thought it was going to work. And I had known him for a while and so he's like, oh, so what are you doing? And, you know, he gave me the title and I was like, oh, that's actually really good because that summarizes what the thing is. It's metabolic flexibility plus, you know, flexible dieting. So that was a good thing. And you know, similar to what your experience is, I do a lot of kiteboarding. So for me to go kiteboarding is a way to process ideas by doing a movement that's semi-new, but not entirely conscious, but unconscious, right? So it's like if you go mountain biking, I do a lot of mountain biking, same idea. Like, you know how to ride your bike, but there's a lot of stuff going on. You kind of have to, you really have to keep paying attention because if you don't, like some bad shit's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
But you're kind of, you can get in a state of flow because you have a baseline level of skill in order to perform it also. So I find putting myself in those kind of state of flow, whether it's with movement or without movement, like, and just letting myself just be in the moment, like all of a sudden, like weird ideas just seem to show up, quote unquote, out of nowhere too. So that's when I kind of initially had the idea for it. Before I got there, I just didn't know what it was. So I was explaining to him this thing I had thought about and he goes, oh, flex diet certification. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. That actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah. That's it. So, okay. So man, a couple of things there too, but, for people that are listening to this, using flow as a way to improve thought is right. Cause you can only analyze for so long. You've got to let go and like allow your mind to do what it does. And the two things you mentioned there is like picking an activity, which is, I guess you could say dangerous enough to keep you present. So you've got to stay focused. But then the other part is you've got to have a level of competency that allows you to go autonomic as well, right? So it's sort of finding that balance. And I'll find I'll work on a problem for a while, especially writing, and then I'll go mountain biking. And, and somewhere in that balance, I'll get through the idea, hopefully.
Yeah. And the thing I found too, is just to forget about it. Right. So in a perfect world, before I have a period of time where I'm able to go kiteboarding, like if we get on a South Padre or something like that, I ideally will put in like the output that I want. Right. So I'm doing a next level certification. So I've done this a couple times through this process of, okay, what is the next thing I want? I think I want it to be this thing. So next level certification, whatever. I think I want it based on these three or four parameters. Great. Hey, what is all the research I need? So I'll pull all the research, read all that as much as I can for 2, 3, 4 weeks beforehand, and then literally go on a kiteboarding trip and not bring anything with to read other than something that's completely the opposite. And then I'll just go ride, hang out, drink beer on the beach, eat Pop-Tarts, whatever. And then I'll just write down stuff that I happen to think about. So it's like you're almost like purposely unplugging to allow your subconscious to do the work for you. Mm. Where I think in the past I've been like, oh my God, I'm not working on the problem. I'm never going to solve it. But like, think of, you're like, oh, what was that person's name? That one movie, I can't think of it. It's on the tip of my tongue. And if you go to someone, you're like, ah, just don't worry about it. You'll remember it. And you like distract them. Like literally almost every time, like 5 or 10 minutes later, like, oh, it's this thing.
Yeah.
Right? Cause subconsciously they're still working through it, but it's almost like you had to let it go and just let it be subconsciously processed. And if you try to hold on to it and you try to actively force it, it just doesn't seem to happen then, which is just fascinating.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's great advice for it. If, I mean, that it does not matter what you're struggling with. You can only analyze it so much. Right. And then you'll pattern yourself around the problem at some point and you're really screwed. So you got to just like let it go. So what are you working on right now, or what ideas kind of have you had recently that you're really excited about?
Yeah. So recently I've been doing a lot more on a physiologic flexibility, right? So I initially had the idea for the flex diet start June of 2018. I met with Ryan and I told him at that time, I'm like, yeah, and I have like the next level and everything already planned out. He's like, whoa, hold on. You need to lose like 2 years before you do that. Like get one thing out, you know, and do that well, and then worry about the next level. I'm like, no, but I've already been thinking about this for like 4 years already. He's like, just shut up, go out, do the thing, do the thing,
right.
Which was very good advice.
Get the real-time feedback.
Yeah. So the flex diet is looking at mainly nutrition and recovery, right? So how well can you use carbs? How well can you use fat? How well can you switch back and forth? And then what are all the different things that affect that? From, you know, light movement and eat to formal exercise to sleep, obviously macronutrients, micronutrients, fasting, things of that nature. And I think for most people, that's probably going to be a really good start, right? Most people, if they've got a good exercise program already, trying to manage all the other things is going to be the next thing. But I keep thinking, like, what is the next level up from beyond that, right? So especially like the humans you work with, you know, we're pretty good with our sleep, pretty good with our nutrition or exercise, you know, it's all pretty good, pretty dialed in. So I'm like, okay, well, what are the other things what's the hierarchy of the body? Like, how does the body prioritize stuff? I believe it prioritizes by survival. Ah, okay, if it's prioritizing by survival, what are the key things for survival at that point? Right. So breathing is probably going to be at the top of the list, water, maybe food, shelter, different things like that. Okay. So that kind of gives us a little bit of a hierarchy of the things. So what if we extend that into what physiologic systems have to be very tightly regulated in order for you to survive? I'm like, okay. So I would be thinking, pH,
S-A-P-H, right? Yeah.
If your pH goes off even a little bit, you know, up or down, man, you're going to be in a world of hurt, right? So your body is doing all this complex stuff in the background to make sure that it stays within this very tight range. Blood glucose is another one. Like, so at any one point in time, in terms of fuels floating around in your body, a healthy person has literally about 1 teaspoon of blood glucose, and it's just held very, very tightly regulated. Another one would be temperature, right? 98.6 is an average, but man, you can't get more than a couple degrees, you know, above or below that in terms of an actual core, body temperature, or you're in a massive world of hurt. Mm. I'm like, okay, so maybe it's those things are what's called homeostatic regulators. Those things have to function. Your body is going to do everything humanly possible to make sure that those things stay within a tight range. I'm like, okay, so we can't really measure them that well. Even if I could get a really accurate pH, it's probably not that useful as an intervention because it's so tightly regulated, right? So people are looking at like, well, how do I know if I'm like deficient in magnesium? I'll just look at blood levels of magnesium. It's not that useful because again, those ions are very, very tightly regulated. You'll leach bone, you'll pull it out from all sorts of other places to make sure that that stays regulated. I'm like, okay. Well, we know that for temperature, for example, we can put people with adaptation in very hot environments, and we can put people in very cold environments. So maybe we rank the thing in terms of the stimulus that we put into the body. That's the thing that we focus on. So we'll look at, okay, how high of a temperature can you maintain and still feel pretty good? How well are you tolerant to cold? Right? If we look at pH, can we do things to alter pH? If we allow movement into the equation, we could blast the crap out of you with a bunch of lactate work and put you on a rower and tell you to do repeated 60-second wind gates. You will hate your life, and you will feel like your quads are on fire from lactic acid, which is lactate and hydrogen ions. So acutely, you're literally dumping hydrogen ions. You're literally dumping acid into your system and trying to buffer it. Different breathing techniques can do the same thing, right? So going through all this list of, okay, I think here's the regulators. I think that to be a robust human, increasing your physiologic flexibility by these homeostatic regulators, what does that translate into in actual English then? Oh, it looks like a lot of the stuff people are playing around with now. Hot, sauna, exercise in the heat, cold water immersion, breathing, right? So breathing has the ability of changing CO2, right? CO2 is directly tied to the amount of acid, quote unquote, that's in your body, right? So you can make your blood more basic or more acidic just by changing breathing patterns. So looking at all of those things together and then be like, okay, how do these things all fit together as a system? And where do individuals start on them to get the maximal adaptation out of it?
And now when you talk about adaptation, you mean, what do you mean by adaptation?
Yeah. So if we dump you in like say 45 degree water and it takes you a minute before you can actually take a normal breath and you're not yelling and losing your shit. Okay. Yeah. You probably have a little bit of work to do. Like, so fast forward 3 weeks, can we do that same thing again? And within like two breaths, you're like pretty chilled out. You're not sitting there freezing. You're not shivering. You're not hating the world. It's never fun. But can you control the amount of stress that's applied to you? That could be as much mental as it could be physical also. Right.
Okay, I see. So essentially taking somebody and pulling them away from all of their homeostatic regulation and having them adapt to those stressors.
Right. And so if you think about like slider switches, right? So I'm thinking, okay, here's the temperature one. How far can we push this human away from normal? Oh, let's put them in 40 degree water up to their neck. And how long can they kind of hang out in there? But the catch is, can they do it safely? And can they make it look rather easy? Because I think if you can do those two things, your adaptation is probably going to be better, right? So you're going through what's a eustress period. So eustress is stress you can more easily recover from. Distress is stress that takes you quite a while to recover from. So just like training, right? I'm always amazed, like if you look at top level CrossFit athletes or whatever, ultramarathon runners, without question, usually the peak of the peak of the elite, they make just insane stuff like look pretty easy. Like Rich Froning made the CrossFit games look rather easy to him, right? You watch Zach Bittner run, he doesn't look like he's in agony the whole time. He actually looks pretty damn smooth. You're like, how the hell does that guy do that? Right? They're doing crazy things, but they're making it look relatively easy because to them, they've trained all that stuff to the point where it's literally more of a eustress. You drop someone else into any one of those conditions, it's just a massive freak out and it's a huge amount of distress. Why? Because they don't have the adaptations to handle that level of a stressor. And the nice part with homeostatic regulation stressors is that you can go all the way down and you can grade them to wherever they're at, right? So if you've never deadlifted, we could start you with an empty bar if we wanted, right? You can always start within their current capacity. So if you don't like cold, hey, maybe 7 degree water is like really chilly for you. And you grew up your life in Florida and it was, you know, 60 degrees and you'd wear a sweater to the beach, right? We can probably start at a place where within your current capacity, it's just a little bit up to that edge. And just like training, we're going to do just a little more. Okay. Ooh, now let's try 65 degree water. Let's just go 2 minutes, right? So you can gradate all of those stressors relatively easy. And in terms of measurement of it, just looking at, can you control your breath? Does it look rather easy? How does it feel, right? If it feels just horrible and you're hyperventilating, yeah, we probably went a little bit too far. We probably definitely went into a distress area. And you'll still get some adaptation from that. It's not that you never want to go there. I just think that if you're constantly doing distress, you're going to way outstrip your body's ability to recover from it. And at some point, it's just like taking your car and redlining it all the time. It's like, man, the car goes faster. Yep, car goes faster. But at some point, there's going to be a pretty high cost you're going to have to pay for that.
Yeah. So, man, something that I think that the listeners can definitely benefit from is listening to your methodology and how you approach these things. It seems as though you have a very, you know, you could say complex understanding of these, how these things work. You have all the, you know, the biotech data and the inputs. And at the same time, you're always looking for minimum exposure to create adaptation, it seems, which I think part of why we're in such a problem right now is we are so used to having we're just adding more to training, and we have, you know, three different pairs of shoes that we wear for like one CrossFit class. And you know what I mean? It's like, you can just see like people's backpacks getting bigger and bigger and bigger with all the stuff they need to train. And so I love your approach to always look at the minimum kind of exposure needed or dosage.
Yeah. I always think of, as an engineering model of, I think of expansion and contraction, right? So I'll purposely do periods of expansion where I'll measure the shit out of everything. I've got a friggin' metabolic cart. I've got a Moxie sensor. I'll stick a heart rate monitor on myself because I want to know mechanistically what's going on. I'll grab some other humans, measure them. But at the end of the day, I'm also a realist to know that most people aren't going to go out and buy 10 grand worth of equipment just to get in a thing of cold water, right? So can you back out of that then? What is the easiest indicators that they can use? And you know, vast majority of the time you're back to like, how does it feel? What's your breathing pattern? Maybe heart rate, right? And if you just use those, you can get pretty close to where that kind of borderline is for you, right? And even just trying to get people to tune into their own body too. As much as I love measuring stuff, I think it's great. You know, the example I've used is like, have you ever done like a back squat? I had this happen to me for quite a while. So I kept forcing myself to do back squats, and I would send videos to all these people, and they're like, I don't know, man, it looks really good. How does it feel? I'm like, it feels like utter dog shit. It feels horrible. It's like everyone would be like, yeah, it looks pretty good. You could actually put some weight on the bar, but other than that, it looks pretty good. I'm like, but every time I would run a cycle of back squats, I'd end up with hip pain, low back pain, like something. But I intuitively always knew that this just doesn't feel right. Like something feels off. And I think sometimes just giving ourselves permission to trust what that instinct is and being able to differentiate that from, this is just really hard and I kind of need to get through it, right? Doing a 2K on a rower, and if you only breathe through your nose, odds are you're probably not going to mechanically damage yourself, but it feels horrible.
Yeah. Right?
Sitting in cold water, it feels horrible. If you're doing it for a short exposure, very unlikely you're going to damage yourself, but man, it doesn't feel like it. But can you differentiate the two? Can you differentiate, yes, this is very uncomfortable, but I feel safe, versus, oh boy, I crossed a line. I'm definitely not safe now. It's time to get out.
Right. Yeah, totally. And, you know, for people that are going to follow your work after this, or who already do, I'm super interested in how this physiological adaptation protocol comes out that you create, because really, like, the benefit is it's when you're not in cold water, right? It's,
oh, totally.
That's like, totally. People ask, like, why would you do all this stuff? It's like, because in your day-to-day life, it's like, if you play with the polarities, then you get really good at holding the tension in the middle.
Yeah, I always tell people, like, the extremes inform the means, right? It's like, and how I ended up getting into cold water stuff was, I was kind of interested in the adaptation. And then two, I was like, okay, so what are ways you could challenge yourself almost every day that from physiology is relatively safe as long as you're not a complete idiot, but you're not going to burn yourself into the ground, right? So I could go to a CrossFit gym and I could do 3 Metcons a day. Is that really hard and challenging? Absolutely. Am I probably going to destroy myself? Most likely, probably yes, especially if I just jump into it. But what are the things could I do that are hard, but are not really quite distressed, like the cost? So I'm looking for like an asymmetric risk profile, right? What is the potential upside that's kind of unbounded, even if we don't know it, but we really have a really good idea of what the downside is and what the cost is, right? So if I tell you, okay, you're going to do a 2K on a rower and I'm going to tape your mouth and you're only going to breathe through your nose, I've automatically limited you not to go to your max because you can't breathe through your mouth, but it's going to feel utterly freaking horrible. Mm. But you could probably do that initially without a lot of training, 2, 3, maybe 4 times a week, right? You could go there a fair amount. And to me, that's true mental training, as much as I think that term is just way overly abused by how most people use it. Mm-hmm. Can you stay checked into the whole process, not check out, like be entirely aware of what you're doing, keep doing the thing, knowing that you're probably relatively safe, but yet it's hard. Like every part of your being at that point says, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this thing, but can you kind of keep doing it in a safe and kind of repeatable manner, if that makes sense? And exactly to your point, to train yourself when you're in situations that are paradoxically not that, right? Can you laterally transfer that set of skills? And so where I figured this out was like 3 or 4 years ago, I was in Mexico. It was the last day we were there. A buddy of mine's like, there was a big north wind. And so all these like monster waves showed up. Well, monster for me are only 6 to 8 feet. They're small for surfers. But for me,
overhead,
I was like freaking out.
Nobody's bitch though. Overhead. Oh, crush yeah. Your life.
Oh yeah. And he's like, bro, you'll be fine. Go out. We'll watch. It'll be all right. And so I go out there and the waves are all just not lined up at all because of the way it was underneath. So you would see like this 8-foot wave and would disappear and there'd be another one. And I get out there and I started just losing my shit. I'm just like, oh fuck. I'm just like hyperventilating. I'm getting crushed by a wave. My board gets ripped off. Finally get my board back. And then I realize I'm like, oh, I just need just to ride and not do anything and just breathe and just like calm down. But I also realized at that point that, oh yeah, I've probably never really adequately prepared myself for this, right? So when I came back and survived that, nothing bad happened. I'm like, okay, so what are things I can do that's a little bit more stressful in a controlled environment so that I don't have that level of risk, but I have a little bit more training to feel like I can trust myself a little bit more. If I do get put in a weird kind of situation, I have a little bit of the training and the skills because I practiced it in a safe environment in a eustress situation that hopefully I can then, you know, transfer when I need to.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. So I guess I know we've gone kind of long here, so I just want to ask this final question. So how do you approach, I guess, are there parameters that you use to approach mental training for people? Is it really about minimizing that risk factor, that downside? How do you go about adding some sort of mental component into someone's training plan?
Yeah, to me, a lot of times it depends on where they're at and what they're trying to do, right? So another way I figured this out, I had a moderately heavy like CrossFit athlete about 2 years ago, and I just could not get him to stop doing like he would do the training I programmed, and then he would go to his gym and do another like WOD of the day. And so I eventually asked him, what's going on? He's like, oh, your training's too easy. I'm like, explain to him, you know, the concept of eustress and you want to get stronger so you can't beat the crap out of yourself all the days and all that. He's like, oh, I kind of get it. I was like, but then he kept doing the same thing again. So that's when I was like, okay, what can I give him that's hard that he feels is really hard that he'll do, but it's not going to beat him up real bad. So I'm like, okay, so you're going to do a 5K on a rower and you're only going to breathe through your nose. It's like, what? That's not that hard. I'm like, okay, do it. Come back to me. Comes back. He goes, oh my God, my heart rate never got above 125. It felt like I was drowning in air.
Yeah.
I'm like, perfect. I'm like, what are you going to do tomorrow? Okay. You're going to go do like reverse sled drags. And then you're going to do a 2K, breathe through your nose, right? Do something that's very hard, concentric stress only, lots of quad stress. Yeah, mechanics, not that hard to do, right? So I had to kind of figure out what are ways to kind of trick people into doing things that were hard just so they wouldn't continue to beat themselves up. And then I realized, oh, maybe this is kind of a form of mental training, right? And that's how I got into, you know, cold water, heat, that kind of stuff. So stuff you can do that's short to train the ability to be like, okay, it's time to go. I'm going to do the sucky thing. It might suck, but that's okay. I'm going to do it. You know, like you've done a lot of cold stuff. The first time you get in the cold again, it still doesn't feel good. Right. I don't know if it's ever going to feel good. And that's maybe not really the point. The point is, can I train myself to be present, to do the thing that's hard? Yeah, I'll feel a little bit better afterwards. To me, I think that's more mental toughness or training than just going to the gym and getting the crap beat out of you at a potentially high risk. You know, because the reality is what I realized with most of my life is I don't have hardly any risk, right? I mean, like my life is almost a little bit too easy.
Right.
You know, it's like, how do I inject in a safe manner some stuff to train myself that, okay, if it's go time, it's time to go. How do I practice that? Even in just kind of small, safe amounts.
Right. Yeah, totally. And so, you know, I'm continuously amazed because I'll do repeats on my bike, nasal breathing only. It's like in that moment, I'm dying. Like it's yeah. rough. You know, you're like struggling, like try, and you're forcing like your rib cage up. You're doing everything yep. to get air in there, you know, and then 30 minutes later, like tapes off the mouth and you're just completely fine.
Yeah. So. Oh yeah. And I think those things have a lot of transfer too, because you then also realize what your capacity is, knowing that you kind of always still have a backup. Right. So it's also the mental game of like, so before I do like rowing or biking, what does it matter? I'll kind of say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. All right. So I have a little rule that when I get on the rower, I'm not getting off of it unless I absolutely 100% believe that I'm going to be injured. Right. Because otherwise, the second that you get off like halfway through a 5K that sucks, oh man, that just kind of haunts you because now you let yourself out. Right. Mm. Now your brain's going, ah, there's an out. I don't have to do this. Oh, my time isn't what I want. Oh shit. I'm just going to quit and do it tomorrow. I think that's a slippery slope as much right. as I hate the slippery slope analogy.
Right. Right. Totally. Yeah. Training yourself to finish hard things is massively important. And then, you know, the other thing that you just, most people listening to this can just think about in their own lives, like the thing that you struggle from is the inability to control your nervous system, to control your physiology. And it's, you know, one headline on the news, or normally like you'll read like 50 headlines and then next thing you know, you're in this sympathetic state. And so just training your mind to bring your physiology under more of your control, I think would benefit people in just a massive way, regardless of sport, you know?
Yeah. Anything. Yeah. And at the end of the day, the point is never, it's not to not become sympathetic, is how fast can you then transition, right? So if you look at metabolic flexibility, how far can you use carbs? How far can you use fat? How fast can you transition back and forth? Same thing with the autonomic nervous system. Like how far can you go on the sympathetic end of the system? Like if it's go time, can you go? Are you ready to like to go? And then when it's not go time, how fast can you get to parasympathetic land? Right. So I think of like the videos of like the 80s, maybe of the old like Russian Olympic weightlifters, right? These huge like sides of beef with eyeballs like wander out to the stage and you're like, oh my God, this guy is doing a world record clean and jerk. He looks like he's going to fall asleep. This is going to be a disaster, right? The guy touches the bar. His eyes look like they could blow laser beams through your eyes, like snatches it, like, or clean and jerk, whatever the lift is, like new world record, sets the weight down, like lumbers off stage, like he's going to go take a nap again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like massively parasympathetic, huge sympathetic when it counts, and then back to parasympathetic again.
Yeah, that's just massive.
To me, that's the goal, right? So do you have the right response when it's needed? Most people have no control over that dial, right? They've never done anything that's hard enough to know what hard actually is, but they've never downregulated enough to know what that's like on the other end of the spectrum. So they're crushed from both ends of the spectrum, and they live in this kind of no man's kind of dead zone area.
Yeah, totally out of control of their own processes, you know?
Yes.
So for people that are listening to this and they want to follow along with you, I would definitely suggest your certification. Do you want to talk a little bit about the best place for them to find your info? And
yeah, so best place is general stuff is the website, which is miketnelson.com. For the certification, which is just flexdiet.com, FLEXDIET.com. Both those places will have a place you can get on the newsletter or the waitlist. Probably 80-90% of my content goes out to the newsletter. So that'd be the best place for more info and contents and way to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on here. And I appreciate all the good questions and experience and everything. So thank you so much.
Likewise. Always a pleasure.